Good evening. The House Judiciary Committee is fed up with what they call stonewalling by President Trump.
When this committee issues a subpoena, even to a senior presidential advisor, the witness must show up. Our subpoenas are not optional. Mr. McGahn has a legal obligation to be here for this scheduled appearance. If he does not immediately correct his mistake, this committee will have no choice but to enforce the subpoena against him.
Secrecy in the trial of the NYPD officer who killed Eric Garner and a legacy of the Manhattan Project to build the atomic bomb in Staten Island. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo, and this is the news for Tuesday, May 21st, 2019. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler proceeded with a scheduled hearing Tuesday despite President Trump's order to former White House counsel Don McGahn not to appear as a witness. Nadler said if McGahn doesn't come in before the committee, it will have no choice but to subpoena him.
We know that the president directed Mr. McGahn to prevent then-Attorney General Sessions from accusing himself from overseeing the investigation into Russian election interference. On March 3, 2017, shortly after Attorney General Jeff Sessions did recuse himself from the Russia investigation, the president summoned Mr. McGahn to the Oval Office. According to the Mueller report, quote, "The president opened the conversation by saying, 'I don't have a lawyer,'" unquote. The president told Mr. McGahn that he wished that Roy Cohn was his attorney instead. Roy Cohn, of course, is known principally as the chief architect of the Army-McCarthy hearings that destroyed so many lives back in 1954, an actual political witch hunt, not the imaginary kind the president decries. Mr. Cohn served as President Trump's lawyer for a long time, defending the president against federal discrimination suits before he, that is Mr. McCohen, was ultimately disbarred for unethical practices in 1986. Mr. McGahn refused to follow blindly into unethical behavior. Mr. McGahn told the president that the Department of Justice ethics officials had weighed in and that Mr. Sessions would not unrecuse himself, and he advised the president not to have any contact with Mr. Sessions on the matter. Days later, the president did exactly the opposite. He summoned Mr. McGahn and Mr. Sessions to Mar-a-Lago, where the president again, quote, expressed his anger, unquote. He said he wanted Mr. Sessions to act as his fixer. He said he wanted Mr. Sessions to undo his recusal and to limit the scope of the investigation. But Mr. Sessions, too, refused the president's orders. On June 17, 2017, the president took his displeasure a step further. He called Mr. McGahn at home and directed him to order Rod Rosenstein to fire Robert Mueller. "Mueller has to go," the president barked. "Call me back when you do it." Once again, Mr. McGahn refused. This time, Mr. McGahn felt the president's behavior was so inappropriate that he said he would rather resign than trigger a constitutional crisis. In early 2018, after press reports described the president's attempt to force Mr. McGahn to remove the special counsel on his behalf, the president repeated his pattern. He summoned Mr. McGahn to his office and he got angry. Quote, "This story doesn't look good. You need to correct this. You're the White House counsel," close quote, President Trump told Mr. McGahn. "What about these notes? Why do you take notes?" the president said to Mr. McGahn, inquiring why Mr. McGahn had documented their conversation. The president then told Mr. McGahn to tell the American people something that was not true. He asked him to deny those reports publicly. Mr. McGahn again refused the president's order. He refused the president's order to lie to the American people on the president's behalf. 6 months later, the president announced that Mr. McGahn would be leaving the White House. The special counsel found Mr. McGahn to be, quote, "a credible witness with no motive to lie or exaggerate given the position he held in the White House."
Democratic members of the committee who hold the power to begin impeachment proceedings say the White House has left them a step closer to supporting an impeachment inquiry. For some, it was the straw that broke the camel's back, with several members calling for the proceedings to begin immediately. House Democratic Speaker Nancy Pelosi has opposed impeachment, but others say they're frustrated with the White House, signaling they might soon have no choice but to consider an impeachment inquiry. Such a move would tap stronger investigatory power to compel subpoenaed testimonies and documents. Meanwhile, in New York City, testifying in the disciplinary trial of an officer accused of using a banned chokehold on Eric Garner, another officer involved in the fatal 2014 arrest, said he wrote up paperwork exaggerating the seriousness of the dead man's suspected crime. Officer Justin D'Amico testified Tuesday during the disciplinary trial of his partner, Officer Daniel Pantaleo. Pantaleo, who is not facing criminal charges, now faces possible firing. A medical examiner testified last week that Pantaleo used a chokehold on Garner and set in motion a lethal sequence of events. Garner was suspected of selling loose, untaxed cigarettes. D'Amico testified he filled out arrest papers after Garner died that included a felony tax charge that would have required prosecutors to prove he'd sold 10,000 untaxed cigarettes. Christopher Dunn is the legal director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. He says many people feel the trial of Pantaleo has become a waste of time.
Police department trials are largely secret proceedings. That's a huge problem. And the Garner prosecution perfectly illustrates that. The trial itself is open to the public if you can get into police headquarters. But that's the end of it. The decision will be secret. The discipline will be secret. Basically the entire process is shrouded in secrecy.
Now, I know that I was reading an article, I think, earlier today. One of the witnesses, potential witnesses, just said, I'm not going in. I'm not going to have anything to do with this. One of the people who actually saw what was going on. What do you think? Is this common that people just don't participate?
It's not unheard of for witnesses not to participate in trials, but what's going on here is that after 5 years of delay, many people have concluded that it's just a waste of time to participate in this process, and it's completely understandable they have concluded that. It should not have taken 5 years for this case to go to trial. This officer should have been held accountable a long time ago. And the fact that people won't participate just shows they've lost faith in the system.
You know, it's interesting to me. It took 5 years. Somebody on tape was shown being choked to death, and now the truth is being choked. I mean, everybody knows what they saw in that video, and yet a whole different story is being told. How did that happen? How did the only person to be held accountable was the person who actually filmed the event happen?
The videotape is quite striking, and people all around the country, all around the world have seen it. There wasn't a whole lot of dispute about what happened here, given that this case should have gone to trial a long time ago. The police department and the mayor's office has a lot to do to try to restore public trust, because by delaying this proceeding, they've really undermined any public belief that police officers will be held accountable and will be held accountable in a timely way.
The message seems to be they're just not going to be held accountable.
It would be easy and right to conclude that the police department doesn't think that what happened here doesn't matter. Given how long it's taken to get to trial. And if they thought it really mattered, they years ago would have tried to prosecute this officer and years ago would have provided some public accountability.
Well, why doesn't it matter? What is it about this? And what, as a citizen, you know, especially African-American citizen in America today or in New York City today, what should we be worried about that doesn't matter?
What is so wrong here is that this was a serious act of police misconduct. Person ended up dead for no reason. And instead of acting quickly to deal with that misconduct and to try to bring some justice to the Garner family, the police department has sat on its hands for 5 years, and the city of New York has sat on its hands for 5 years. And when it does that, it just sends a loud and clear message to the public that, as far as they're concerned, it doesn't matter that Eric Garner is dead, and that is completely wrong. The delays in bringing this case to trial are a very clear sign that at the highest levels of the city, including at the police department, they didn't take this seriously and they don't care enough about it to move more quickly. And for anybody who cares about public accountability and police misconduct, that's a terrible message. This case is highlighted as the secrecy that surrounds police discipline in New York State. That follows from a New York State law referred to as 50A, which basically makes all police disciplinary information confidential. That's a law that's got to be changed, and there are now efforts to change it. In terms of what police officers can do in making an arrest, the police, of course, can arrest people who engage in unlawful activity, but they can't use excessive force, much less can they be choking people to death. And that's what happened here, and the force that was used here plainly was excessive. And the department should have moved years ago to deal with the excessive force that resulted in the death of Eric Garner.
Is this Pantaleo or is this New York City NYPD?
Well, this is a case about an individual police officer who ended up killing a man, but the follow-up from the city is about the city and about the police department. The implications of this case go far beyond this police officer and cast into serious doubt any sort of confidence in the police department's commitment to transparency and accountability.
Christopher Dunn is the legal director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. A final decision about Pantaleo's punishment lies with the police commissioner. And a judge in state Supreme Court on Tuesday lambasted the MTA's poor wheelchair access in subways. Judge Shlomo Hagler says the MTA wasn't doing enough to install elevators at its 472 city subway stations. Only about a quarter of stations are wheelchair accessible. And Judge Hagler added, it's time the MTA put the money where their mouths are to fund more elevator installations. Joe Rappaport, the executive director for one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, the Brooklyn Center for Independence of the Disabled, says it shouldn't take a lawsuit to get the city to follow the law.
He definitely said some of the right things. He did not make a ruling today. What he did say is that he was prepared to make a ruling either when we go back to court on June 5th or very soon afterwards. He asked the MTA and our attorneys if they were ready to have oral argument. He's been pushing for a negotiated settlement, but there's an impasse. There's no negotiated settlement. So what the judge said is, okay, we'll have oral argument and I'll make my decision. The MTA said it wasn't ready, so the judge said, come back to court on June 5th. At the same time, the judge definitely made it clear his impatience with the MTA. He is a firm supporter of accessibility. He called on the MTA to get moving, to commit money for elevators in the subways, to follow the fast-forward plan that calls for 50 stations to be accessible by the end of the next capital program and then more stations to be accessible beyond that. But he said very clearly he would decide on the MTA and the City of New York's motion to dismiss based on the law. So while he said things that we think are very helpful and promising, he did not make a decision today, and we don't really know what his decision would be.
What exactly is the extent of the problem?
The MTA is a state authority, reports directly to Governor Cuomo, and there's no doubt that it's challenging in the subway environment to keep elevators and other things in good shape. In Boston, however, much smaller system, but they reached a court agreement that requires them to maintain all their elevators, and they do. So 99.5% of the time, their elevators are operating, except when they have some routine maintenance and so on. That means that the chance of your encountering a broken elevator in Boston is about 1 in 200. And here in New York, it's much more likely that you'll find a broken elevator, maybe 1 in 15 or 20 elevators are broken. And if you're trying to get from one place to another, you need elevators working at both ends. If it's working at one end and it's not working at the other, that's not going to help you very much. One thing that the MTA has repeatedly claimed is that it doesn't have the money to put elevators in. Here's why that argument no longer makes sense, if it ever made sense. The MTA won funding $32 billion from congestion pricing and other taxes. for the next capital program. That is a ton of money. So they can no longer plead poverty. They can no longer say we have other priorities. They have enough money to do some of the other things they need to do and make the stations accessible. The other thing that we're suing the MTA about, though it wasn't before this particular judge, is about how the MTA has renovated stations repeatedly across the system. We sued the MTA last week because they keep doing this in direct violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act.
How do they get away with that? You know, take a law that lays it out pretty clearly what you're supposed to do, and they don't do it for year after year. Why do you have to be in court to enforce a law that's so clear and that other cities do? What's happening in New York?
Right. The MTA answers to no one, I guess, except Governor Cuomo or previous governors. It really is a good question. And one of the things that I've learned in my time here at the Brooklyn Center for Independence of the Disabled is that often it takes legal action to get the government or private entities to actually obey the law. And that's what's happening here.
Where do things go from here?
Well, we want a fully accessible city in every way. So my organization, along with others, sued to make taxi cabs accessible. We've pushed for the Taxi and Limousine Commission to make Uber and Lyft accessible. They're not doing a very good job of that. We want the elevators accessible. We want accessoride accessible. We want accessible housing. There's a lot of things that we are pushing for. We've made some progress, but there's a lot more work to do. One of the things that's clear is it takes a lot of work just to get the MTA and the city to adhere to the law.
Joe Rappaport is the executive director of the Brooklyn Center for Independence of the Disabled. There are four lawsuits currently against the city for failure to provide access for disabled people. And a part of the history of the development of the first atomic bomb lies buried in the soils of Staten Island. The borough, which has often been virtually ignored, served as a garbage dump for the city in previous decades. The massive Fresh Kills landfill was closed in the 1990s and turned into a park. But when the NYPD conducted an inspection after 9/11, looking for background radiation sources that might confuse a search for radiological weapons, they uncovered a forgotten history. Staten Island, especially near the Bayonne Bridge, had been the storage spot for uranium from the Katanga region of the Congo that was used for the first atomic bombs. But officials also discovered the borough had been used as a dump for radium, once widely used, now banned. The discovery led to the closure of Great Kills Park, hundreds of acres developed by then Parks Commissioner Robert Moses. Tom Robleski is chief editorial writer for the Staten Island Advance and SILive.com. He says it's no surprise that what he calls the all-powerful Uber bureaucrat Robert Moses played a key role.
Great Kills Park, it's a large federal park, part of the Gateway Park system, run by the National Park Service on Staten Island, East Shore, kind of south a little bit, had a lot of open space, had ball fields, bird sanctuaries, a model plane field as well. It's been closed for a number of years after radiation was detected. They did an anti-terrorism flyover in the wake of 9/11, and they noticed a number of hot spots. Talking about 240, 260 acres thereabouts have been closed for a long time.
Where did this radiation come from?
When they created the park back beginning in the 30s and 1940s mostly, they did a lot of landfilling with sanitation material from all over the city, and different things went in there. At that time, radium was used a lot, had a lot of military purposes, you know, the glow in the dark. It had a lot of industrial purposes. So there was some stuff in there that was like radium paint, deck markers for ships during the war, all different kinds of things like that. On top of that, the land had also eventually became part of the park. There had also been a city incinerator on the property back in the 20s and in the 30s. And a lot of that, the residue from that was just kind of dumped in the area as well. So this was back before we had any kind of environmental consciousness in this country at all.
And you mentioned in your opinion piece Robert Moses. What was his role in this?
When they first started doing the park, he was the parks commissioner. He'd already had a number of, he was a state parks commissioner, and he had a number of other titles in state government. And as we know, he also was the same gentleman who gave us the Fresh Kills landfill, filling in the marshlands and beautiful natural areas on in the middle part of Staten Island in order to build on them. But then, oops, they forgot that they were going to build on them, and they just left it as a landfill for 50 years, operating illegally all those years, according to any federal and state guidelines.
What is it about Staten Island, such a nice place with some beautiful old communities, wound up in one of the oldest parts of the city, wound up as the garbage dump for so long, at least parts of the Staten Island? How did that happen against the wishes of the people?
We didn't have a lot of political power, and the political power kind of comes and goes. These days, we don't have much because when a Republican, we've been able to give a Republican the votes. We gave Giuliani the votes to become mayor. We gave Bloomberg the votes to become mayor, along with other parts of the city. But that hasn't always been true. It's basically a, sort of the red dot in the blue city, so to speak. It's more conservative voters out here. So, you know, we were able to, it was easy for them, and especially back in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, where we did not have a big population out here, and we were kind of like cut off before the bridge. It was a lot easier for people, city officials, state officials, federal officials, to kind of have their way with us out here because, you know, who was paying attention back in those days?
What is the government doing as far as a cleanup?
First, they have to examine, and again, the point that the piece makes is that while the federal government now is responsible for the land, while this dumping went on, it was a city park and it was city property. And the radium is like, if you're familiar with the you know, the Radium Girls scandals with the painting of the clock faces, and they didn't know that it was radioactive. That's what a lot of this stuff is in here. There have been paint cans of radium, and again, they had other uses as well. And that stuff was sort of just part of the city waste stream at the time, as hard as that is, you know, to believe these days. So that's the kind of stuff that's out here. And they have to find out that now they're really examining the whole area. Part of it has already been examined because we're building the seawall sort of on one part of this property, off this one part of this property, in response to Hurricane Sandy. So that area has kind of been looked at. Now the National Park Service, the Army Corps of Engineers, they're looking at the rest of the property to see how bad it is and what has to be done to remediate it. The city has acknowledged that they have some responsibility for this, and they are helping to pay for this, but it's going to be a very, very long process and likely a very expensive process.
Why so long?
It's a vast area to have to look at. And also, if you're going to, and one of the Army Corps folks was explaining this to me a couple of weeks ago, the park has to be for, like, active recreation. That's its mandate. That means, you know, maybe ball fields. So you've really got to make sure that when you say that this park is clean, you know, kids are going to go into a park, they're going to dig in the dirt. You know, kids, if you have kids, I have kids, they're going to put the dirt in their mouths. The dirt's going to get on their clothes. They're going to take the dirt home with them. You have to make absolutely sure. And, you know, the feds, they have very, very high standards when it comes to this kind of safety. An overabundance of diligence, and it's a good thing that they're doing it that way because, of course, we want everybody to be safe.
Because a lot of work with Staten Island was done, little do we know, from the Manhattan Project as well.
There's an area on the north shore of Staten Island on Richmond Terrace that has been identified. I'm not sure if it's technically a Superfund site, but it was identified as a place where material from the Manhattan Project had been stored sort of in those... Another place is on Staten Island, Brookfield Landfill in Great Kills was another place where actually somebody, the supervisor there, was arrested, and he was prosecuted by the former DA here on Staten Island, Bill Murphy, because he was like letting people come in there at night. He was taking payoffs from them and letting them dump who knows what, medical waste, anything was dumped in it. And that is also being remediated and is also going to be a public park, just like Fresh Kills. And I, as a native Staten Islander, I grew up here, was here my whole life pretty much. The blight that was, the smell you would smell in the summertime just driving past it on the highway, was a lot of people's only experience of Staten Island. And so to have that close and now to have it be like a big park is actually one of the greatest things that's ever happened in Staten Island history.
Tom Robleski is chief editorial writer for the Staten Island Advance and SILive.com. As an addendum, a kill in Dutch is a narrow watercourse. And finally, companies specializing in the handling of radioactive material are buying retired U.S. nuclear reactors from utilities and promising to clean them up and demolish them in dramatically less time than usual, 8 years instead of 60 in some cases. Turning nuclear plants over to outside companies and decommissioning them on such a fast track represents a completely new approach in the United States, never before carried to completion in this country, and involves new technology as well. Supporters say the accelerated methods can get rid of a hazard more quickly and return the land to productive use sooner, but regulators, activists, and others question the rapid timetables are safe and whether the companies have the expertise and the financial means to do the job. Once a reactor is shut down, the radioactive mess must be cleaned up, spent nuclear fuel packed for long-term storage, and the plant itself dismantled. The most common approach can last decades, with the plant placed in a long period of dormancy while radioactive elements slowly decay. Spent fuel rods that can no longer sustain a nuclear reaction remain radioactive and will generate substantial heat. They are typically placed in pools of water to cool, staying there for at least 5 years, with 10 years the industry norm, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. After that, they're removed and placed in giant cylindrical casks, typically made of steel and encased in concrete. But Holtec International, which in the past year has been buying up several retired or soon-to-be-retired nuclear plants in the U.S., has designated a cask it says can accept spent fuel after only 2 years of cooling. Holtec, a corporation with more than 30 years of experience in handling radioactive waste, struck a deal last year to buy Oyster Creek in Forked River, New Jersey, from its owner, Exelon Generation. However, as we've reported on this news on numerous occasions, many folks out there in New Mexico and Texas, where this stuff will be stored, have been opposing and calling this program and this policy of quick decontamination of these plants and demanding that this waste be kept here and in the places where it was originally generated. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, May 21st, 2019. The news was engineered by Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Thanks for listening. Remember, call our pledge line number, 516-620-3602, or go online to give to WBAI.org, or text the letters WBAI to the number 41444-41444. Become a BAI buddy. Pledge in the name of the WBAI Evening News. I'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.